signings that, you know, I'm a foot taller than both of them. I know I could kick their asses. So. And my ship Andromeda was a pretty badass ship too. So, but it's fun. It's cool, and he's a good guy. I get a kick out of him, man. The energy. I hope I have that energy at 88 years old. Is all I gotta say.
Awesome, great question. We had another one right here. Yeah, hold on, we got a microphone coming for you. I think it's fixed too, so you're ready.
Who are some of your biggest influences as an actor?
You know, I started watching movies at a very young age with my mom. My mom loved old Hollywood movies, black and white movies. For me, it was Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, Jimmy Stewart, Rock Hudson, Cary Grant. I loved all those things, man. I still tell actors today, and I tell even people, watch these old movies, man, from Casablanca to Philadelphia Story to Zorba the Greek, whatever. But really when it kicked in for me, it was anything Paul Newman was in. Paul Newman was to me, and Robert Redford as well. Paul Newman to me was the guy. And we only got to meet one time, but he wrote me an amazing letter that's still on my wall today next to the one I got from Anthony Quinn, because Anthony Quinn played Zeus for the first year. But we had 5 two-hour movies before it became a series. And to work with Mr. Quinn was just so cool. I mean, here's a guy nominated for 6 Academy Awards. He won twice. If you think of the classics, Zorba the Greek, Lawrence of Arabia, Requiem for Heavyweight, all these amazing movies. And I asked him, you know, he was 78 years old when he took the role of... They initially went out to Charlton Heston, another one of my favorites. And so I got to meet Charlton Heston at his house because I was training for 2 months. When I got the role, I was training for 2 months leading up to going to New Zealand to start filming the movies. And so we went to Charlton Heston's house, and it was so cool for me to meet him. And he goes, I don't feel comfortable playing this role, he says, because Kevin, I'm just not funny. He said, I can't do it because I'm not funny. So I asked Mr. Quinn, why did you take this role? And he said, I'm 78 years old. I've always wanted to play Zeus. When will I get the opportunity to do this? And it was interesting. I never could call him Tony. He always wanted me to call him Tony. I always called him Mr. Quinn for a whole year. It drove him crazy. We remained friends up until he passed away at the age of 86. And I would visit him in his house in Rhode Island. And he gave me one of his sculptures. This guy was an amazing artist, painting, sculpting. So that's mine. And then he never wanted to rehearse the scenes on the set. He didn't care about the blocking. He said, I'll just show up, you tell me what was going on and what I need to do. But he also wanted me to go into his camper to do the lines reading and go over the script. And he would sit there with this big magic marker and go, oh, this is crap. I'm not saying any of this. I'm not saying. And I'm just going, oh, my God. And he says, I'm going to say something like this, and then you'll think of something, won't you, sweetheart? He always got me sweetheart. And I'm going to talk about an actor. You're like going, oh, you really have to listen, because he would just go off. And but he was brilliant at it. And there was this one scene that they built this beautiful barn. It was like 3 times the size of this room we're in right now. It was huge. The ceilings were at least double the size of this. And it was a big scene. They put like 3 cameras up, different angles, just to shoot the master. So they had a big wide master, a smaller master, but still. But it was just a big master shot before they're going to come in for coverage. So I went in and blocked it for them. And then Mr. Quinn comes in, and he's got his Zeus robe on and stuff. And he sits down, and there's two bales of hay next to some other bales just sitting around it. He sits down on 2 bales of hay, and he just kind of sits back. And Josh, the director, says, okay, Mr. Quinn, this is what we're going to do. Kevin's going to come in through the barn over here. He's going to bring the horse over here. You're going to get up. You're going to appear over here. Then you're going to walk into me. He does all this stuff, telling him every single shot. He spent like 10 minutes going over. And Quinn just sat there the whole time listening. And then when he was done, Quinn says, yeah, I'm not going to do any of that. And he says, I'm going to appear here on these bales of hay. And then I'll stay here the whole time. They just spent like 2.5 hours lighting this scene, you know? So we're just like, okay. So we said in action, I bring the horse in, he appears, and then we start doing the dialogue, and what are you here for, blah, blah, blah. And I work my way. As an actor, things happen spontaneously, and sometimes you don't know why it happens. That's why I love the profession. I love the whole thing. And I just worked my way over to him. And I sat down on the lower bale of hay, so I'm looking up at him. He's my father, you know, he should be above me. And it's still one of, again, goosebumps, it's still one of my favorite scenes I've ever done in my life. And it's just, and he wasn't doing it to be a jerk. His reasoning was, I'm the king of the gods. I don't go to people, they come to me. And he wasn't wrong. He was completely right. And it ends up being such a great scene because it played up in the close-ups anyway, played in the two-shot and the side shots and the singles on each other. So it was just kind of cool. And we used to go to dinner every Saturday night. There was an Italian restaurant in Parnell. Parnell's a suburb of Auckland. It's a string of all these little restaurants and shops. And Parnell was a renovated house that we went to, Antoine's, his Italian restaurant. And so we're sitting there, and he's sitting right across from me. And then Eric Grundemann's here. He's the other executive producer, the only other American that was down with me the whole time. And then it was his wife, Yolanda, and that was the longest of his five wives or something in terms of his marriage years. And he looks at her and goes, Yolanda, go to the bathroom. She goes, I don't have to go to the bathroom. Goes, go to the bathroom. So she stands up. Goes, oh, you want to talk about the girls now? I do, yeah. I know. So you speak about the girls. And he waits till she's just out of earshot, watches her walk down. He reaches across the table. He grabs my hand. He says, sweetheart, what can you tell me about this thing they call the G-spot? I said, Mr. Quinn, you've got 15 kids. You've been there. Trust me. So... we got a couple hands back there.
Well, while we're getting the microphone back there, I'll bump in for a quick question. Did most of those scene rewrites he did stay in the final show?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Most of it? Okay. The thing is, a lot of this stuff was exposition. And that, you know, I learned a lot. And, you know, writers have the toughest job. But the reality is, the audience isn't stupid. Don't treat them that way. If I'm walking through that curtain, I don't have to say, I'm walking through the curtain now. You know, you'll see me walking through the curtain. If I go off camera and you hear the toilet flush, you probably took a leak. I mean, you know, you don't need to write all that stuff in. And he would take out the exposition. And he was right.
Yeah.
He was right.
Awesome.
Yes.
When you auditioned for Hercules, did you think it would become one of the biggest shows in the 90s, as big a phenomenon as it was?
I'm gonna back up a little bit in that to show you go through the whole process. They auditioned 2,800 actors for the role. And all of North America. And when I first got the call from my agent, I was with ICM for years. They're one of the bigger agents in LA. And they said, hey, they're going to do five two-hour movies of Hercules. It wasn't going to be a series yet. It was going to be 5 2-hour movies. And I just kind of went, yeah, you know, I'm a big guy, but they're going to want some, you know, like Stephen Nash next to me. They want a guy 6'9", 300 pounds, and just massive. And they said, you know, they're looking for guys that are more NFL quarterback size guys or decathlon size guys. And I went, okay. So I went and read. Thought I did a good job. I left. A week later, I get a call from my agent. They want to see you again. Okay. Did a good job. Walked out of the room. Got back in the car in the lovely Los Angeles traffic. Takes an hour to go 16 miles. But, you know, it's fun. So I get a call again the next week. They call me back 7 times. And now it's the final thing because we're actually signing contracts. They make you sign contracts ahead of time so they can basically screw you over. It's Hollywood's way. So it was just 3 of us left, okay? So I get in the room that was about this many people in there, but it was all studio executives, male and female, all the Universal Studio hotshots. Anybody ever been to Universal Studios in LA, Studio City? So a lot of times when you get off the 101 freeway, you drive up the park to go into, there's a big black building that's right there as you pull in. We call that the building where actors go to die. Okay, so I get there, and it was a film room, so it was like a theater, so there were graduate seats, and they had a big screen behind us, and we got up on the stage, I was just above everybody, in the front row is Sam Raimi, our executive producer, you know him from Evil Dead and Spider-Man and everything else, and Rob Tappert, and everybody from Universal has anything to do with a lot of cooks in the kitchen there, trust me. And so I get on stage and I said, okay, you had me back a lot. You've never given me new sides, new script. It's always the same scenes. Is there anything you want me to do different? No one's ever given me any direction. No, we like what you're doing, Sam says. Just do it again. Well, and so I read with the actress and They said, okay, it's good. And then Sam looks at the woman next to him, and she gives him a little nudge, and she says, oh, yeah, I'm supposed to ask you to take your shirt off. She says, and if you remember, I was in pretty good shape back then. So I took my shirt off, you know, and they went, oh, okay. Then Sam says, so if you get the role, would you be willing to shave your chest and stomach? I'm not like, you know, a bear, but I've got a man covered, you know. I'm not Robin Williams. So I said, oh, I'm sorry, I thought you wanted a man for this role. And I started walking off stage. And I got a big laugh in the room. And I said, they said, well, we'll let you know. We're going to make a decision within the next week. So I left the next morning. I flew to Vancouver to shoot an episode. I was a guest star on The Commish. Remember the Michael Chiklis series? So I'm in Vancouver. 3 or 4 days into filming, I get a message. Please call your manager ASAP. I call up Beverly. What's going on? She goes, you got the part. She's screaming. You got the role. You got the role. And so I walk on the set. And I walk up to Chiklis and I said, I don't want any crap from you. I'm half God now. And when I finished filming, I got back to LA, and in 2 months, I was already working out all the time before then anyway because of the frustrations of rejection in Hollywood. But I got to work with Douglas Wong, who's one of Bruce Lee's original students. And this guy was amazing. And he had a thing called the White Lotus Kung Fu style and weapon training. And we worked like 8 hours a day, 6 days a week for 2 months before I left for New Zealand. And then when we started filming, Michael Hurst, of course, played my sidekick, Aeolus. In the third movie we were doing, something happened that brought me back to Paul Newman and Robert Redford. And I said, we got a Butch Cassidy and a Sundance Kid thing going here, Michael. People are going to love this show. Because I remember telling Sam Raimi, I said, we got to make sure people laugh with us and not laugh at us. Because a series like this, it's easy to become really cheesy and make people just make fun of it. Here, people knew. You guys were all in on the joke. We had some serious ones, but there was a lot of wink, wink, and, you know, breaking the fourth wall, Gilligan's Island, whatever, you know. And it just, I think the humor just made it so much fun, and the stories were great. And we kept it with mythology, but we mixed it up. I call it Malibu Hercules, you know, so. But it was just so much fun. And I told Michael by the end of the middle of the third movie, I said, I bet you'll make this a series. A few weeks later, we get a call, and I said, you're staying there. We're going to be a series. And by our third season, we became the most watched show in the world. So God bless you guys. Thank you. You never know. You never know.
We have a very eager one right here for a question.
Yes.
If you could be any character in Hercules other than the character you are, who would you be?
Wow.
You're getting good questions.
That's
here.
That's a good question. I would be Aries. I would have picked Aries. You know, Kevin Smith was a very dear friend of mine. I loved that role. It's something fun about playing a bad guy, you know, but still with the comedic element to it. And Kevin and Bruce Campbell became very dear friends. They became my golf buddies down there. Whenever Bruce came down and guest starred quite a bit on the shows. And they loved golf. I love golf, but I'm good at it. They're not. But it didn't matter. I also said they should have recorded our golf outings because that's a reality show I think people would have loved to see. Because Bruce is the type of guy, if we had to wait a little longer on a hole for a group in front of us, he'd put a little automatic hammock up between two trees and lay in the hammock and wait till it got better. But Kev Smith was just a dear friend, and I miss him dearly. He passed away in an accident on a set in China. So when I go back to New Zealand, I bring our favorite beer, Max Gold. Any beer drinkers, order that from New Zealand, Max Gold, wonderful beer, and I put one on Kev's grave, and I sit and drink mine and have a chat with him every time I go back there. Class act, great guy. He left 3 small boys behind. His oldest was 10, and now that son is 27 and about 6'6", 240 pounds, plays on the rugby team down there. He's just a beast. And Kev would have been proud, but you know, I miss him. He was a good guy.
Awesome. We had a question right over here. Oh, was that one? Okay, then over here. And then
we got one over here, yeah.
And then we got a lot of one.
So you've lived in an echelon of society that most of us could only, you know, watch shows of and dream of. Is there any lessons that you learned, life lessons that you learned that you don't think the rest of us would learn? Hopefully that sounded bad, but you know.
It's an interesting question. I think we all learn the same life lessons no matter where we are in life. I mean, we all have good times and bad times. I mean, I've been very fortunate to travel the way I've traveled, but I think I put that upon myself when I got out of college. I first went down to Texas to join the theater group down there before making the move to L.A. Spent a year and a half there in Dallas. Had a great time. I was a bouncer at a club on weekends. All the Dallas Cowboy guys would always show up. And then I went to Europe with a girlfriend of mine at that time, and I was going to spend just 3 months just in Europe before finally getting to L.A. I stayed for 3.5 years. I lived in Paris, I lived in Milano, I lived in Munich, I've spent time in Zurich. I mean, it really made me grow up as a person. And I signed with agencies there, and I did a lot of commercials. I started doing commercials in college. Minneapolis, a lot of people don't realize Minneapolis is headquarters to a lot of big companies. So Target, 3M, Honeywell, Cargill, A&W, Dairy Queen, Best Buy, I mean, the list goes, Pillsbury, General Mills. So I did a lot of commercials. So I already had that all-important Screen Actors Guild card, that SAG card that you have to have to get into anything. It's such a weird catch-22. You get to L.A. and it's like, we want to put you in this movie. Oh, you don't have your SAG card. You can't. Well, then how do you get it? Well, you got to be in a movie. You're going, well, okay. You know, it's a weird battle to finally get that card. But I already had that card. And when I went to Europe, I shot over like 50 commercials in 3.5 years with the agencies I was with. So I went in with a head of steam into L.A. already having a commercial agent signed up when I sent my material ahead of time because I didn't know anybody in L.A. I didn't know a single person. So when I moved out there finally, I booked my very first commercial audition. My very first audition in L.A., I booked it. Ended up being a commercial to shoot in Sydney, Australia. So I'm from a little town of 7,000 people, okay? So next thing I know, I'm on a flight to Sydney, Australia. And then I went, huh, I wrote a book report on this place when I was 12 years old. I'm gonna stay. I called my agent and said, I'm going to stay here a while. They flipped, you just got to L.A. And I said, yeah, but I was always on beer. So I got a great apartment on Bondi Beach. If you guys remember the 2000 Summer Olympics, the beach volleyball that they had on TV, that was the beach I lived on. And I stayed for 8 months. I did 3 plays, shot 7 commercials, had a blast. Met a girl from a rock and roll band. She's my girlfriend the time I was down there. And just had a blast. I finally get to L.A. And I started pursuing it. I was very fortunate because of all the commercial I'd done. I never had to work another job in L.A. And every actor is working another job in L.A., trust me. So I was very fortunate that way. But in terms of life lessons, I think you learn a lot. I mean, I'm telling my kids now, my oldest just turned 18. I said, you're such attitude. You think you know stuff. You don't know crap. And we all can relate to that, right? And then you hit 25 years old and you go, yeah, my dad was right. I didn't know that much. And you hit 35 and go, yeah, I can still learn some more stuff, you know? So I think the biggest thing in life that I've had to learn is patience. Because I think we all, in today's fast-paced world, and everybody's got no attention span, and the 6-second videos, you know, that's all I got time to look for. You know, my kids, I go, get off your phone, because it's just kiddie cocaine, you know? I mean, it's constantly, and to me, it's like, go get outside and walk around, you know? We don't do that anymore. You see parks empty. When I was a kid, I'm sure a lot of people, we were in parks all the time, playing whatever, any kind of game, just doing stuff. Nobody does that anymore, you know? And to me, it's I think patience is the biggest thing I had to learn. I'm the biggest life lesson. I think it's been, makes life a lot easier, you know? But I hope that sort of answered your question.
Perfect. Yeah, over here, that gentleman. We're
the gentleman in the tank top, yeah.
Was there a scene?
Hold on 1 second. Here's a good life lesson. Don't let anybody ever set your limitations. Because a lot of people will tell you you can't do something. The heck you can. Stick your mind to it. Failure is a good thing. You learn from failure. Every rich person I ever met and caddied for at these private country clubs told me, you fail and you fail and you fail, but you get better from each one. Nobody's on overnight success. And we need to, that's where patience comes in. Okay, go.
Was there a grouping of scenes or from any of your shows or movies that was so funny that was hard to get through or anything like that?
There was a scene. We ad-libbed a lot, especially on Hercules. I used to piss off the writers, but then Sam would say, Raimi would go, but it's funny. Keep it in. and the writers were in LA, and we're, you know, 9,000 miles away in New Zealand. There's a lot of scenes in there. There was an episode, the Golden Hind, who ended up being the woman I actually ended up marrying. It was half deer and half woman, and it was the blood of that Golden Hind that gods feared because that could kill them. And so in the opening scene where we had another one of the big bar fights and Yolis and I are throwing guys around and this guy runs in and he taps my shoulder and I think he's coming for a fight. But I was in such a fight mode. I pick him up and put him over my, he goes, no, I need your help, Hercules, I need your help. I put him down, what's going on? He starts talking about this person, this creature. And he goes, well, no, it's not really a creature. I mean, it's more like a deer. And I said, we got to add this. So we want a doe, a female deer. So we threw it in there. Michael Hurst could not get through it. We did it 12 times. And if you watch that episode, you'll see that the one take they could use, they cut out so quick before they do the intro music of Hercules. And he could not get, you know, was she more like a deer? And I said, a doe? And he goes, a female deer? And he couldn't get through it. And it was so funny. And there was another one we did, we did so many, now I get my mind thinking about it, where I told the camera operator, I said, they were shooting, they did our shots this way to each other, and then they put the camera to the side to do a two shot. We're sitting in a tavern having a big mug of ale, you know. And I said, when we finish the scene, when the dialogue's done, I said, just tilt the camera down under the table. So we're talking, and it was a very serious conversation. Michael, we got this. They tilt it under the cable, and Michael and I are playing footsies with each other. So. But it was, you know, it was fun. We joked about the series will never end. It was like Hotel California. I put the sign up, we can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. And we joked about how we'd be like 80 years old, big beer guts, and we'd be on our, you know, on the in front lawn having this beer and rocking chairs, and people run up, Hercules, and we'd go, remember when we fought the Hydra? You know, something like this. But it was just fun. I know we had some more questions up
here. Yeah, we got a number of them over here.
Go over right here. The suit. Right, go to start with right the suit. Here. Mr. Suit right there. You're dressed up way too nice for this.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I was curious about, I was impressed with your role in God's Not Dead, mm-hmm. and I was wondering how, if you could tell us how that came about, how you got started in that movie.
Well, it goes back one movie before from the same writers called What If, which was one of my favorite movies I've ever done. And Dallas Jenkins is a dear friend of mine. His father's Jerry Jenkins, wrote the Left Behind books. And Dal sends me, you know, he sent me the script. He says, hey, I just want your thoughts on the script. I feel like it's pretty good. And so I read it, and I called. I said, who's playing Pastor Ben? And he said, I don't know. We got no money for this. I'm trying to figure out the list. And I said, well, I want to play it. And he was, what? And I said, yeah, this is a great script. And he says, yeah, but I can't pay you. This movie has no money. I said, I don't care. This is a really great script. And they got John Ratzenberger in it. They got Christy Swanson in it. I mean, it ended up being we shot up in Michigan. It was such a great script. I loved it so much. So 2 years later, the same writer, same company said, hey, we got this other movie called God's Not Dead. Would you be interested in it? And I said, well, yeah, send me the script. And we read it once again. Great script. I wanted to direct it. It didn't happen. But we shot that one down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And that little $2 million movie, $2 million guys, you gotta understand, it sounds like a lot of money, but in Hollywood, it's nothing. And as I tell people, and I mean it sort of in a funny way, but the reality is that's not even a catering on a Pirates of the Caribbean or an Avenger movie. Those, you know, those are $250, $300 million movies. And this little $2 million movie made $140 million worldwide. And it was interesting. When they said, we hope to make $10 to $11 million on the movie. It made $10, $11 million on the opening weekend. And so it became so successful. They sent me to New York, Chicago, and of course I was already in LA. They were in like the third or fourth week of filming, still in packed houses watching this movie. And they would hold off some seats in the back for myself, the writer, the director, and just to sort of, what would happen is that during the closing credits, people weren't leaving. People were applauding at the end of the movie. And I remember these two older women in front of me, they were right in the row in front of me. And the character, I played pretty, kind of a jerk. I play a really jerky college professor. And she looks at her other one, she goes, that man, he is such a bad person, isn't he? I'm right behind him. And then what happens at the end of the movie, they would stop the credits and turn the house lights up, and people would all kind of look around. and the title's called God's Not Dead. And I'd come down and go, God's not dead, and neither am I. And I'd walk down, and they'd freak out, and we'd do like a Q&A like we're doing now in front of that particular little audience, and it was kind of fun. But it was great to be part of that. And those guys are still doing a lot of good movies, I think, a lot of good family movies. So anyway, with someone.
Yeah, we had one up here, and then the gentleman in the jacket's been raising his hand okay. A few times, yeah.
So we'll go right there with the jacket. So stand up so they see you there. Pass the mic down to him. We could pass it down like at a baseball game, like a hot dog. Make people move.
So,
hot dogs. Oh, go ahead.
I don't know a whole lot about acting. And
neither do I. I just fake it.
So I'm currently watching the Andromeda series. I love it so much.
Thank you.
And I wanted to ask you, it's hard to formulate this question, but how was it kissing almost a new girl every single episode in that show? And how did your wife feel about it?
You know, this is interesting. When the first season came out, I did a Comic-Con in Tulsa. And the Q&A was 2,000 people in this room. It was crazy. And a woman said, she goes, you know, this, you're the first captain after Captain Kirk. In season one of Star Trek, Captain Kirk kissed 12 women. You only got to kiss like four. And I went, I'm going to talk to the writers about this right now. I have a DVD. I should make more of these things. And I used to show, you don't have a screen in here, because a lot of times at the Comic Cons, they have screens for the panel rooms. I made a montage of Hercules stuff, like fighting with rocks, fighting with swords, fighting with other bodies. Because a lot of times I picked up the smallest stunt guy and use him as a little batarang or something. Humor. And then the last one is titled Kisses. And it's to the Tom Jones song, I Want Your Kiss. And it shows me kissing, I don't know, at least 50 different women. And every 2 weeks on Hercules, they sent down a beautiful woman for me to work with. And it was a great dating service for me. And by season five, I'd met my wife that way. So, you know, she hates that I say that, but it was a lot of truth to it, actually. And we called it Baywatch BC because we had a lot of cleavage on my show, too. So just nobody ran in slow motion. This gentleman right here. Then we'll go back there.
I met you a few years ago in Phoenix. You had your son with you.
I did.
You introduced him as your finance minister.
He's amazing. He would be here right now, but I have a new movie that we're making the rounds in the country right now at film festivals. And I was just in Steamboat Springs. We kicked off the Steamboat Springs. We had a full house theater, standing room only, over 300 people. And so he's up there now because he's emceeing the whole event. So he's loving it. That was in the football stadium, right? In Phoenix? Yeah. Wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was amazing. It's where the Cardinals play.
Yeah,
it was cool.
It was crazy. But you answered my question, kind of. I was wondering if he was still handling your finances.
He is. The next one I'm doing is in Tyler, Texas. So come on up, meet me in Tyler, or come down.
I'd like to see him again.
But I'll be in the Rose Capital of the world. Isn't that considered the Rose Capital of the country? I think it is.
Sure.
Tyler, Texas. Sure, whatever.
Is he going into the business?
He's in Miracle in East Texas, and he's in the last movie that we had in theaters for 3 months last year called Let There Be Light. He was in that one. He did a great job. Both my boys did a great job in it. So I mean, I think he's 6'4" now. The kid grew since then. He's grown about 7 inches. So he's got me by about a half an inch, and he lets me know. I know. I'm sorry.
All right, maybe one or two more. But the young lady in the dress right here has been raising the hand for a bit.
Being a Christian actor, how did it affect you playing an atheist in God's Not Dead?
It's in the writing. And I know I plan to have atheist friends. You know, I mean, I'm a Christian. I'm not afraid to say that. I'm probably a bad one because I don't go out there and, you know, convert people. I mean, I try to do the movies that I do. I'm not there to force it on people. I got great friends who are agnostics and atheists. We have great debates. Without getting angry about it, you know, in this angry, hateful world we have right now. It's like, I'm a live and let live guy. If you're that way, fine, let's talk about it. And I'm not there to change people's minds with it all, but I know atheists that I've seen and met that are just so filled with anger, and I said, okay, that's the guy I'm gonna play, you know? I mean, I've seen guys on CNN and Fox and MSNBC, and their veins are sticking out, and I go, why do you get so angry about something you don't believe in? You know, do you get this pissed off about Santa Claus too? I mean, the Easter Bunny? I don't know. It's like, I hate faith-based movies titles. I call them family-friendly because atheism is a faith. For you to absolutely believe in nothing, that's, wow. That's pretty good conviction right there, you know? So I think every movie has an agenda to it, you know? But I'm just trying to put out, I used to get stopped all the time I travel a lot, through airports, through malls, through restaurants, by Hercules or Andromeda. 80% of the time now, it's because of the family movies I do. And people say, please make more movies like that. When Let There Be Light came out, I got a call from Netflix right away. And I've had multiple meetings with Netflix over the last 7-8 months. And they're saying, look, we need to get in. I said, well, look, there's 80 million homes out there you guys aren't paying attention to. There's a lot of people still want a family movie that just, you can call it cheesy all you want, but that's what they want for their kids. Why do you not pay attention to that? It's beyond me. So the door is open with me with Netflix, and we're working on a couple of things right now. Because there's, you know, a lot of stuff that comes out. I mean, I'm not a prude in any way, but it's like so violent and so mean and filled with hate. And you're like going, you know, maybe we should try to, I mean, you look at the top 100 grossing movies of all time. Most of them are comedies. Most of them are animation stuff, you know? So I'm not saying Hollywood stop making the movies you're making, but at least, you know, why don't you mix it up a little bit and get movies in there that have a you know, a family message or something. I don't know. Anyway.
Awesome. Right up here for one more.
Hi. What is the hardest part of acting for you as an actor?
The hardest part of acting? I'll give you the Hercules schedule because it was pretty brutal. This is not a complaint because I loved it, okay? Up at 4:30 in the morning and then get home by 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night, every day. That was my day. We'd be on set 12, 13, 14 hours a day. It'd be lifting weights 2 hours a day afterwards and then the drive time in between. And then I would have to study dialogue. If it's well written, to my mind, if it's well written, I memorize, I'm good at it. If it's funky and weird and awkward, I'll call the writers and say, can we reword this? I'll work with the writers, because the writers have the hardest job. They really do, and they take the most crap. Because I've been in the mini sets where they wrote this stuff, you know? People are looking at this. But the hardest part overall is getting a job, because it's all about rejection. You're too tall, you're too short, you're too fat, you're too thin, you're too old, you're too young. Everything's about something about getting rid of you. One time in one pilot that I got that never got put on TV, I remember Tom Selleck did like 7 or 8 pilots for TV shows before he got Magnum PI. It's tough. There's a lot of reasons why shows don't get put out there, and a lot of them aren't good reasons. They're political. It comes down to, well, I promised him I'd give him this, and so maybe we'll do a show next year, even though the show did well. I did a pilot for ABC in a show that I created. A sitcom. I love doing sitcoms. I did a four-show arc on Dharma and Greg. I've done Just Shoot Me. I've done 2½ Men. I've done the Jim Belushi show. I love that. I love the live audience stuff. So I did a show and I hired Barry Kemp to write it. And Barry Kemp wrote Coach, 9 years on Coach. He wrote Bob Newhart. He wrote Norm MacDonald's show, which would have gone a lot longer if Norm could stop drinking so much. But a great writer. It tested number one in all 8 cities that ABC brought it to. It's called Bobby Cannon. You can go online. You can find the rough cut of the pilot, Bobby Cannon, online. It was sort of Coach meets Cheers. I was playing an aging quarterback for the Chicago Bears, and it's NFL draft day, and my team drafts a stud out of Texas A&M. I realized my days are numbered. And Kate Walsh was in it. Kate Walsh went on to do Private Practice for many years, the redhead. Rocky Carroll was in it, playing my sports agent. He's been on NCIS the last 10, 12 years, whatever. We had a great cast. It tested number one in all 8 cities, and the president of ABC didn't want to pick it up. The 7 shows they picked up of the 28 new pilots that year, all 7 of those shows didn't make it through 6 months. 2 of them died in the first 2 weeks. Why wouldn't he give it a chance? Why do you spend millions of dollars testing it to different cities? And going, well, if it tests number one in all cities, maybe audiences like it. It was funny. And they didn't pick it up. It's still something that bugs the crap out of me to this day. And it would have been an 8-year hit. It would have been. And it's frustrating. Because from an actor, the easiest gig is to get a half-hour sitcom, because maybe you work 40 hours a week. On our TV shows, you're putting 80 hours a week in. So it's just, it was frustrating.
All right, we did get the signal to wrap, yeah, here. So, Kevin Sorbo.
Do one more. One more
one
question.
More? Okay. We can't argue with him, so I'm sorry. Yeah. All right. Yeah, just right up in here.
What was your favorite scene in Andromeda and why?
My favorite scene in Andromeda. That's a tough one. There's so many. I mean, there was good emotional ones. There was good comedic ones. It's like asking what my favorite movie is. You know, it's hard to break it down to that. But I remember the very first scene that I did was with Tiran Asazi, and I love basketball. So I said, look, thousands of years, basketball will still be around. So in one of the docking areas we got, I don't care if you put lights around the rim or whatever. I mean, that's pretty simplex. There's not much you can do to make that game different. So I said, that's a place that I wanted to go to, and I would just shoot around and just, you know. And then, so Tyr comes in, Keith's character comes in, and we're supposed to grab the basketball and shoot baskets with me and stuff like that. So we do the scene, and I couldn't help just start laughing. I said, dude, because he's not a basketball player, okay? And he goes, what, because I'm a 6'5" black guy from New York, you think I should be known how to play basketball? And I said, yes. is that just, pardon the generalization, but every guy I've met in New York, your size plays hoops, you know? So I thought it was just so funny. And then, but we did the scene, and I remember the Gordon, our camera operator, he says, wow, actors that know their lines. And I went, well, aren't we supposed to know our lines? He goes, Kevin, you can't believe the number of people. And these are the guys, my crew was the crew on 21 Jump Street, and then they were the crew on X-Files. And so they came in, I guess apparently a lot of actors, I mean, show up on the set and be prepared, you know? It kind of blew my mind that this was something that, to me, it's like, that's what we're here for, not to learn our lines on set. Get the lines and get them out of your head and let's do this scene and have fun with it. But it was, but we had so many, there were so many things on that show too that we threw in. I told this story to somebody else earlier. Keith, his character, he loved to lean on stuff all the time. He's always just a heavy leaner. You know, he's a big, cool dude, big muscular guy, dreadlocks down to his butt, you know. So there's a scene where he's got to run to the Eureka Maru and the other six actors on the show. I said, everybody lean on something. So we're lean. He runs in there. He's got the dialogue. We're being attacked by, he looks at each one of us. Screw you all. And he walks off the set. It was just funny. Anyway, I'm heading back to my table. We're doing photos. Yeah. Hope to see you guys there.
Awesome. You can see him over there. Thank Kevin you. Sorbo, everybody. Awesome. Y'all enjoy the rest of the weekend.